Okay, it's recording.
Okay, today is February 20th. We're recording the sources for regarding organ donation. There are plenty of pages in your Choveret on this, 55 through 70. And we're mostly going to concentrate on three Talmudic or Mishnaic sources today and how to understand these three sources. And this really is the bread and butter of this course in terms of how Orthodox Jews interpret an original text. Our text is the Torah or the Tanakh. The text is understood in a certain way by our sources, our oral traditions. And what right do we have to reinterpret these traditions in light of new situations that come upon us? I will tell you this, that this is exactly what the conservative movement considered its role in America, to conserve the reforms that were made by that movement here in this country, to conserve as much as possible to maintain a Torah observant aspect in light of traditional rabbinic sources. When the conservative movement rose out of this attempt to rein in the reforms of the reform movement, conservative was very close to Orthodox. I would say that the conservative movement until 1950, where in the early 50s the psak came out from the official conservative movement that if you live in a place that's far from a shul on Shabbos, it's better to drive to shul, observe Shabbos in shul, drive back home, have a Shabbos lunch, and then finish off Shabbos, right? Rather than not go to shul at all. Okay? That was an official psak, I believe it was 1951 here in America. And this has been a downward spiral from here in the conservative movement. What was the lumdus of it? The Torah says do not light a fire on Shabbos. Right? Riding a car is not lighting a fire in the traditional sense. So it's better to violate whatever the rabbinic law is entailed in driving a car than to miss shul. Right? If you were on this board of this discussion, what would you tell a person who asks this question? Because in 1950, I got to tell you, even until 1950, here's the reform movement, right, on this hand. Here's conservative and here's Orthodox. Conservative and Orthodox are very similar. They're both interested in kosher food and keeping the holidays and Shabbos and even going to the mikveh. Right? Studies showed that the person who identified as a conservative Jew is very close to an Orthodox Jew. Just the main difference is that he davened in a shul on Shabbos where men and women sat together. But other than that, you're a modern Orthodox Jew. Let me tell you, I davened in the shul of the vice president of this university in the Bronx. It was a vigorous hashkama minyan at 6:30 in the morning, which I remember attending as a child. You know why? So that the men can have a minyan before they go out to work. The vast majority of this shul, it's an Orthodox shul, its plaques are up on the third floor when after it was sold for a penny, so it wouldn't be a church. We went with the rest of the Bronx. And most of the men in the shul went to work on Shabbos. Right? Only a handful of us who went to yeshiva in this whole shul. 400 kids were in the public, were in the youth school on Tuesday afternoon and Sunday morning. A handful of us went to yeshiva. And I still keep in touch with all of them. We're all from today. But everyone else in the shul, not so much. What differentiated those people from conservative Jews? There wasn't a conservative shul in the neighborhood. But if there was, maybe they would have gone there. Right? The only difference is that in this shul, there was a balcony. Men and women sat separately. You hear it? Okay, but other than that, the conservative movement was very much like the Orthodox. But what's the difference between the word Orthodox and conservative? It sounds very similar. Right? I don't know if the conservative movement likes to be called that today anymore. Orthodox was a terminology given to us by someone who wasn't Orthodox. Orthodox means true, orth, doctrine, true doctrine. We believe we have the true doctrine, and if you have true doctrine, you don't move away from that doctrine. Okay? So there are three sources in Chazal. Let me to make sure you remember the three that our presenter on Thursday discussed. Three sources in Chazal that are germane to this discussion. One, if someone's head is cut off, that person is considered dead for Tumah with Manafka Mina. Very simple. There's it has to be a Jew because a Gentile doesn't have Tumah Sol Hel. A person has his head severed here in this room, and the body is still moving around a little, and there's a Kohen in the room, right, who quickly gets out before the body collapses to the ground. Yeah? So is that Kohen Tumah or not? So it's yes. As soon as the head is severed, there's Tumah in this room. That's all. Okay? So what do the rabbis, if you read the pamphlet, I'm going to get it. What the rabbis say is that if the brain is no longer sending signals to the rest of the body, and what do we say about that person?
Brain dead.
Okay, it's called brain dead, but what do we say about the nature of this Mishnah? If the brain is no longer sending signals, there's nothing going from the brain stem down to the spine, is not giving signals to the rest of the body, then what do we say about that person? He's decapitated. His head is cut off. Right? According to this, remember I interjected at that time to tell them, Adarabba, according to these poskim, someone who is diagnosed as brain dead, right, his claim was that if someone came back to life after that, just as sure as you can't come back to life after your head has been totally severed from your body, so too, if you were really brain dead, you couldn't come back. When someone claims to come back, then I can agree with this. Then it was a misdiagnosis. That person obviously wasn't brain dead. We don't have the power of Tchias HaMesim. Right? When people are brought back from such a situation, right, they always claim to see a great light. Christians say they saw Jesus at the end of the life, right? Jews don't usually say we see anything because we don't have a picture of that. You know what I'm saying? What's your picture of God? Any of you ever have a dream of God in your dream? Right? The first thing they do if they think you're brain dead is they can open, I don't want to do it to any of you, but they open up your eye like this and they shine a very bright light that should make those pupils move if there's any brain activity. Right? Even if you're in a deep, deep coma, those pupils should move from such a right? So if that person somehow was brought back, right, the brain recorded that shining light, right? And then their mind, when they came back, remembers that. Right? There's a teacher in this school who has such an experience. The teacher's here, his name is Professor Chaim Sol. He's had a very, very close event like that, and he says he saw, he described people in his from his grandmother's grandparents that he never met, never saw in a picture, but he described seeing them and talking to them, and then they said, no, you're not finished, go back. Okay? Talk to him about it. Anyway, here is the question. Is that if this person has a severed head, you with me? If this person really has a severed head, you have to be careful. A Kohen is not allowed to walk in the room. Following? This is a person doing bikacholim. He should not walk into a room with a person who is brain dead because even though there's a machine respirating his lungs and there's blood that is circulating throughout his body with oxygen in it, following? This person is dead. Right? Remember the other problem I mentioned besides the Kohen and Tumah? Any home? Doctors are going to take blood from this patient. On Shabbos too. From doctor, who's on call, is doing his rounds, also has to take blood on Shabbos. From every patient. Right? Sometimes there are programs that work out, you know, it's like a Shabbos program, if any of you are, you know, in my day, when I went to this school, a class like this would have 20 pre-med students. How many pre-med here?
Amazing. Oh, this is Sims. Okay, got it.
Okay, but I'm just saying. So they it was more of a reason to have you know, these discussions back then. But the doctors are going around.
I want to know. I'm taking blood on Shabbos, right? You can say if the person is dead, so it's not okay, Dovni Gedulo or Gozes or anything like that, right? But still, this person is being Mechal Shabbos for someone who's not alive. Maybe we shouldn't be doing that. That's source one. First source, decapitation of the head. Source two. There's a Gemara that says that a pregnant woman dies. Right? Remember who dies first? Fetus dies first. Right? Now, this is not the discussion of Rodef, we said before, where we consider the baby inside her. Certainly, we consider it a living thing. It can be identified, but it does not take the precedence over the mother. If someone commits an abortion inside the mother, right? What's interesting is that the Gemara considers that to be murder for a Ben Noach. Did you hear that again? Listen to the pasuk the Gemara cites. Listen carefully. Show faith, dom. Ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafeich. Are you listening to you? Shafeich dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafeich. Listen to the words. How does this forbid abortion? This is before Matan Torah. It's for a Ben Noah. Here, he's, what did he do? He killed a person inside a person. Shafeich dam ha'adam ba'adam. You shed blood inside the person. Damo yishafeich. You're a murderer. So the Gemara says that's for a Ben Noach. So, I mean, that's an interesting thing. Can a doctor perform an abortion on a Ben Noach? Because to a Ben Noach, it's murder. Or can we support abortion for Bnei Noach, knowing that for a Ben Noach, that's forbidden? Following the Daf Yomi now in the Sechus of Abzara, we're not allowed to be the impetus for a Ben Noach to violate his mitzvah. We'd be violating with Ne'ivah Lo Siten Mishal. Okay, that's what we live in a country where, you know, we take this for granted, the right to no restriction whatsoever on abortion. But just understand that for many people in this country, it's mamish murder. Jewish law does not consider that murder. It considers it only to be allowed under certain circumstances we discussed a week ago. Go back to our question. Just parenthetically, since I mentioned this pasuk as being brought by the Gemara to teach abortion is forbidden for a Ben Noach, there is another way to understand the pasuk. Shofech dam ha'adam, if someone commits murder, don't say it's up to God to kill that man. Hear the words. Shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishofech. A man shall shed the blood of the murderer. Don't say it's up to a powerful deity to get even with this guy. Like Christianity said, "Shofech dam ha'adam." Someone commits a murder and sheds blood for a man. For adam damo yishafeich. A man shall make sure by man shall his blood be shed. It's a whole different way to read those words. Yes.
Well, we said about other things though, like God will punish them. Like if you do something, you'll punish later. Then why can't just
when thing? If we are unable to, the person deserves a punishment. We should make sure that we get. Punishment prevails. If not, okay, they won't say, okay, God will have to get. There's no Sanhedrin today. We don't commit. So we'll say, well, in that case, then we'll say, if we can't. Yes.
So what was these people doing?
Many, well, the Torah says, Make avivi mo mosumas. Someone who beats his parents shall be put to death. So we understand that shall be put to death means by man. Right? Hasibet says if a man allows his ox to gore three times and keeps killing people, Gamba alav you must. Right? Also his owner shall be put to death. We don't do that. There the oral tradition teaches that it means he ought to die.
Okay, here's an important point I'd like to raise at this point. I'll let you mention this. We believe, and I told you this earlier in the semester, that our original, what we call original intent, what is the Torah's original intent, right? Is we understand, as Talmudic observant Jews, is impossible to determine without an oral tradition. Get this, get it clearly, right? Would you say that about the U.S. Constitution, right? U.S. Constitution is written, and there are volumes that try to explain every single word. Second Amendment has been as volumes in the encyclopedia and books written to try to understand what these words mean, right? But no doubt it's given to different interpretations, right? Today, where this country is being torn apart from liberal to conservative of how to interpret our Constitution. Or whether the Constitution should continue to guide our lives. There is a sitting Supreme Court justice that recently said that the U.S. Constitution does not necessarily need to guide the lives of Americans today. Right? So here is the debate. You've heard of the term originalism regarding the Constitution? No one here knows, has ever heard of that word?
Originalism,
can you picture what it means?
Yeah.
Hey, man.
That has to be followed in its original form.
Okay, close to, let's say, the way an Orthodox Jew would say we have to understand the Torah. Okay? The Reform Jew says that while we acknowledge that there was a time where there was a need to keep kosher laws, right? Because the foods that the Torah prohibits were very, very filthy and very, very dangerous and very unhealthy, right? But now we know how to procure these foods, pork and shellfish and other things like that, in a more healthy way. We don't need to keep those kosher laws. That's a reformist way. It was very much easier for the reform movement to do this when, first and foremost, they taught that the Torah doesn't represent the divine document. There's no divine message there. It was a human being who wrote it, and now we're also human beings, and now we need to get closer to our compatriots here in America. We should no longer keep kosher, because keeping kosher keeps us away from the camaraderie necessary with the people around us. At the first smicha, rabbinic ordination in the new reform movement's smicha in 1869 in Cincinnati, which is why Cincinnati is the bastion of the reform movement to this day. The first reform smicha in 1869 served only on kosher food. No, they didn't have any option for kosher food. So you can imagine they invited many different rabbis from across the United States. A lot of Jews made this before the main influx starting in 1881 in Eastern Europe. So all the rabbis who came were so mortified by the food that was being served at the first smicha that they started what's known as the conservative movement, to conserve what the reform is giving away. Right? So the conservative movement, I tell you, until about the 1950s, did not move so far away. It was only really in the 20s that JTS, you know what that is, right? The flagship school for the conservative movement. And this very school here, Yeshiva University, came very close to merging. You hear that? Came very close. The reasons given in the inner circles for why it didn't happen are numerous, but there were certainly negotiations about it. Okay? As I said, the conservative movement and the Orthodox were very close, right? But a psak that says you can drive to shul on Shabbos, come on. How long is it going to be before someone who drives to shul on Shabbos doesn't see the need to keep kosher anymore? Well, certainly not the mikveh anymore. The correct psak should have been, don't move out to the suburbs until you zone for a place to daven. And until then, find someone's basement nearby and everyone down there. Right? Get by a Torah and get Siddur and make a shul. Lord knows what are these neighbors? These are neighbors like Woodmere, Lawrence, Hewlett. These are places that have these things now. Right? Okay. The Jews got wealthy. They were able to move out from the Lower East Side to these more affluent places, but they didn't have shul, they didn't have schools. So the Jews, the children stopped going to school. Shortly afterwards, the conservative movement made a psak: don't send your kids to yeshiva. It'll affect their ability to mix with the community, right? So this is where we are. Okay. So that's let me get to now to the second psak. A fetus dies before its mother. But what happens when you had cases where a woman very late in pregnancy, right, was killed, and they were able to keep her alive on a machine long enough for a baby to be delivered, right? So what does that prove to someone who wants to read the source I just mentioned originally? I'm looking at four or five people who actually can answer that question because you're actually listening. Tune in. You really are. Everyone's someplace else. Let's just close the computers because I see everyone with a computer, but five of you are probably watching something, three of you are communicating with someone. Come on, this is crazy. Really, just show me that you can answer the question. All right? If the Talmudic source says that the fetus dies before the mother, but there was this case where a mother who was late in the ninth month of pregnancy got hit with a fire escape. This guy just downtown got hit with a fire escape and crushed his skull. So they see this woman is dead, right? But we grab her and take her to a hospital and keep her alive, right? So, and then she gives birth to a baby a day later. But if you insist on the original understanding of this Gemara that says that the baby dies before the mother, but the baby didn't die, the baby was born, is taken out alive in a C-section. So if you insist that the baby must die before the mother, but the baby didn't die, it must be that while the mother was on that machine, she was
alive.
So of course you're going to say, no, come on. If at the time of this Gemara, they had what we have to keep someone alive, they wouldn't have said that. Follow?
The third source is the Gemara at the end of the Sefer Yuma that says that if you see someone where a building falls on top of him and he's covered with bricks, right? The reason why we refer to saving someone's life as pikuach nefesh is because the action of removing those bricks is called lefakeach the bricks. So it's called pikuach.